Welcome to the Men of Eight Gang podcast for Saturday, September 20th, 2008. And we have Catherine Grayson, who is the staff writer for the Twin Cities Business Journal, and she covers the technology beat for the paper. But I've also seen some articles, Catherine, that you've done about the solar array funding and one on biotech a while back. And so maybe you can talk about that when you get to it. Julio Ojeda Zapata, who's a technology writer and columnist at the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and most importantly, the author of an upcoming book on Twitter, which Twitter Means Business, How Microblogging Can Help or Hurt Your Company. And love to have you maybe mention something about that.
Yeah, sure.
And last but not least, John Gordon, who is the producer and host for a show that you probably hear on Minnesota Public Radio's Morning Edition called Future Tense. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Glad you guys could carve out some time, especially on a Saturday morning when here in Minnesota, at least, it's nice weather. I don't know what it's like out in the Bay Area, but
well, it's too early to go outside yet. Come on. I have no idea.
That's right. Well, so you may know the backstory of Minnovate and why we five geeks decided to go ahead and jump in. And excuse me one second. I think this is Graham Thickens. Is it Graham?
Hello, it is.
Graham, hi. We're all on, so welcome. Graham's with our Minnovate group. And at any rate, we started it really because there wasn't a showcase specifically for internet and web innovation in Minnesota. And all of us kept going to Minibar and Minidemo, and we'd see all these, you know, hundreds of people that had a high degree of interest in connecting with one another. And we thought, hey, well, I'm sure it'd be great if someone would start some kind of a showcase venue. And we kind of looked at each other and said, hey, let's do it. So we did. And so far it's been, a labor of love and a lot of fun, but have a few questions to kind of get your perspective on is, for instance, with respect to internet web innovation, how do we compare to other states and markets? And Catherine, I'd like to go to you first because you have obviously a lot of colleagues at different biz journals in different parts of the country. And what do you see happening here versus what's happening in other markets?
Sure. I think that there is a obviously very talented developer community here in the Twin Cities. You know, I would say just as good and strong as anywhere else. I think what a lot of folks see and say around town is that maybe where we're a little short compared to some other folks is on the people who really have the experience in turning great ideas into really strong businesses. And also maybe a little bit, we have a little bit more trouble on the venture capital side, especially in the web and internet space compared to some places out in the valley.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, and that's exactly what you said is echoed by Dick Sommerstad at the University of Minnesota at the business group, who also says pretty much the same thing, that it's, you know, it's venture capital and it's leadership to be able to turn ideas into businesses. But how about you, Julio? What are you seeing with respect to startups and the energy and things that are happening here?
Well, I've been covering tech at the paper for 10 years, and in that time I've done a number of stories about really fascinating technology companies of all shapes and sizes here in Minnesota. And I've frankly been very impressed, and it, you know, ranges from very small companies to outposts for, you know, very large companies like Adobe and Microsoft. There's a lot of stuff going on here, which impresses me greatly. But I've also seen the process sort of ebb and flow, and it's not always consistent. Like, for instance, I live in downtown St. Paul, in Lower Town, in Galtier Plaza, overlooking Mears Park.
And, for now, right?
I'm sorry?
For now. I've been watching your Twitter stream.
Yeah, for now. We got an offer in our condo, which we're excited about. Yeah. But there was a time, for instance, when in a building kitty corner from my complex here, there was a lot of high tech activity in there, and there were T-shirts being made, and we're a mini Silicon Valley, you know, here in Lower Town, and there was a lot of excitement about that, and then all of a sudden that just poof kind of went away. And so I'm not sure the consistency has always been there. I just see a lot of fluctuation, a lot of ideas bright ideas being bandied about, and then you don't hear about them anymore. So there's I echo my journalistic colleagues' opinion that, you know, sometimes the execution isn't always there.
Yep, yep. Well, in terms of Minnesota compared to Silicon Valley, I mean, John, you've got a unique perspective in being on both sides, if you will, where you know, we're considered flyover country, but many people look at Silicon Valley as the Mecca. What are you seeing with respect to energy here compared to maybe when you left and you headed out to the Bay Area?
There definitely seems to be a lot more going on than when I left the Twin Cities, which was way back in 1997. So I'm impressed with the strength and vibrancy of the tech scene in the Twin Cities. But when you compare it, of course, to Silicon Valley, it's, you know, it's nowhere near. And it's this critical mass. I mean, it's the same reason why there have been alternatives to Twitter pop up here and there, but no one's gotten traction. I mean, the people are on Twitter. That's where the conversations are going on. That's where, you know, most people are. So you're naturally, if you're new to that game, you're attracted to Twitter before you're attracted to Identica, or however they pronounce that. And, you know, it's the Silicon Valley has just built such a critical mass that, you know, that to try to challenge it on its playing field, I don't think is ever terribly successful. But that doesn't really mean that much, because cities sort of develop their own identities and their own industries, and any attempt to sort of say we're going to be the next Silicon Valley, I don't really hear that language much anymore. I mean, back in 1999, NPR did a series, I think, called Minnesota in the .com Age, and there was a great deal of hand-wringing about how exactly do we become Silicon Valley of the upper Midwest. And and I went down to Austin, Texas to see sort of what, you know, what they were doing, because they had a certain degree of success. And like the Twin Cities, as Julio was talking about, Austin has sort of ebbed and flowed too. I mean, it's a nice tech center, but any attempt that they made to become, you know, like Silicon Valley, I don't think worked that well. So I guess that's my perspective on it.
Yep. Yep. Phil, you had a question?
Yeah. Let me ask you guys, do you find that, that the Midwest and Minneapolis and the Twin Cities area in Minnesota in general, compared to the coast, do you see that there's more or less angel money? Is it easier to get an idea rolling, on the coast, or is it the fact that, you know, you really need to have a strong business model put together no matter where you are?
I'm not sure exactly how to gauge that. I mean, there's a heck of a lot more money flowing in Silicon Valley, but there's a heck of a lot more competition for that money as well. Maybe it's about the same. I don't know.
Catherine, have you seen anything like that in your experience with dealing with the businesses here in the Twin Cities?
Sure. I think there are a couple very strong angel groups here in the Twin Cities. Obviously, Rainsource Capital, which has been growing. And there's also Twin Cities Angels. Twin Cities Angels focuses a lot more on the med tech side. And a lot of the Rainsource Capital and those angel investors usually, you know, they do look at tech companies and they will invest in them. And there are a few kind of smaller early stage funds, although probably not enough of them. I would say that there is a good chance of getting angel money, but it's definitely quite a bit harder in the pure technology space in the Twin Cities than it is if you're in the med tech space.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things that we've talked amongst ourselves about, and also with various venture capitalists, is and frankly, some of the stories we've been doing, a la Best Buy and what they're doing and so forth, mm-hmm. is not just around the development of, you know, innovative internet and web technologies, but also the usage of them and the adoption of them. And we've been on the hunt to do stories on companies that are doing things in an innovative way with technology, whether it's collaboration or ideation or whatever they happen to be doing with it. Are you seeing, Julio, a number of new stories about adoption? I mean, are you doing more? Are you seeing more things happening in that area?
Which specific areas that specify?
Well, specifically, not companies necessarily creating new platforms, but actually using what's already out there. So using Skype in innovative ways, or using cloud applications in new ways, usage of wikis, crowdsourcing, things of that nature.
I see just literally in the last few weeks, I've been contacted by people that do very good piggybacking. They're interested in Basecamp, they're interested in wikis, they're interested and things like that, and they apply, basically a platform. They identify a very prominent platform, very well-known platform, and then they piggyback on it quite successfully. In the Sunday's paper, for instance, I have a story about iPhone developers, and it's exciting for me when I can identify a national trend like the very active iPhone development that's beginning, and I can identify 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 local examples, and I can sort of string them together into a trend story that has national relevance but is also has a very strong local component. Those kinds of stories excite me greatly. Whenever I can pull all of the strings together and pull off a story like that, I'm very excited. And I seem to recall somebody on this conversation having something to do with that. I'm my memory is failing me. I think somebody on this conversation is involved with that, but you'll have to jog my memory on that. I'm kidding, Graham.
That would be me. Yeah.
Yeah, Graham Thickens is in my story, and I'm in fact looking at a picture of him on the front page of our Sunday business section right now. So.
Yeah, but wait a minute. You want to sell more newspapers, don't you?
Yeah, I was going to say we got to apologize for that.
When I was looking at the pictures of Graham, we were looking at the various pictures we wanted to use. There was one where with the iPhone he's holding up is probably obscuring his face, and they thought, yeah, that's the one we want.
That's the one. That's the one.
Good. I brought along a couple of my better looking younger colleagues for that shot.
But anyway, my point being, every so often I'll save string, as I say here in the business, and then finally achieve a critical mass for a story about exciting technology projects going on that sort of fit in within a larger national trend. Whenever I pull up a story like that, I'm really excited because I think it's really interesting.
Well, here's something that if we could maybe just spend a couple of minutes on the obvious catalyst for internet and web acceleration is the fact that the internet exists and that broadband is key. And yeah, there's been studies about, downtrending adoption and new hookups and things of that nature. But the Ultra High Speed Broadband Task Force started by the state of Minnesota is, at least a recognition that we've got to really vault ourselves forward in many ways. Maybe starting with you, Catherine, as a catalyst, and as something that is so fundamentally important, what are you seeing as trends in attention to driving forward with increased broadband and increased penetration? And, is it still pretty much at the task force level here and elsewhere? Or what are you seeing specifically? And then maybe Julio and John, you guys could jump in on that too.
I certainly think it seems to be a priority here in the Twin Cities. Among the business community, I honestly don't hear people talking about it that much as an influence, at least here in the Twin Cities, on what they're going to be developing or working on, just because business seems to be usually pretty ahead on the curve on that. So, I mean, obviously there's been a lot going on with citywide Wi-Fi and things along those lines, and I would say it seems on the city's part to be definitely a priority.
Are you doing more stories that are broadband-centric, or do you think the demand isn't there yet?
I think that there's certainly is demand for it, and I have to say that I haven't written very much about that in particular, at least lately. So.
And then Julio and John, other than discussions that I know that each of you have been engaged in with respect to net neutrality and so forth, is there anything that is that you see as any kind of acceleration in the trend with broadband?
Well, here in the Twin Cities, I've done a number of stories where high speed internet is becoming more powerful, more ubiquitous. When the Wi-Fi network in Minneapolis went live, it was kind of fun actually. I spent a day just wandering around Minneapolis, you know, having meals and, you know, wandering the sidewalks. And I had a laptop and I had an iPod Touch, and I was tapping into their Wi-Fi, and that was very exciting. It was also kind of exciting when Comcast began offering 50 megabit internet. Service, for heaven's sake, and I'm a Comcast subscriber, so I had them, you know, temporarily upgrade my service, and that was kind of amazing. So I'm seeing things like that happening, but I'm all, you know, also well aware, you know, how badly this country lags compared to other countries, and I just keep, you know, wondering, you know, when are we gonna be on par, you know, with countries on the in Asia, for instance, and. That bothers me a little bit, but it's exciting, you know, as an internet and technology geek, it's exciting to see the ubiquity and the power of internet access, you know, gradually scaling upward compared to when I started, you know, covering technology for the paper a decade or so ago, you know, when I was using a dial-up connection. So
yeah, broadband is one of those things where on one hand you say, why are we so backwards and so behind so much of the rest of the world? I mean, you can look at it that way, and then you can also, as Julio was saying, compare it to, you know, when we all first got online, and how much better it is. So part of it just sort of depends on your perspective, I guess. But one interesting interview I did on Future Tense not too long ago talked about broadband as a sort of national security issue, where and this is with Bill Woodcock, who's an expert in how the internet works and internet growth and cyber defense. He I can't remember the name of his Packet Clearinghouse is the name of his group. He actually went to Estonia a year or so back when Estonia was under cyber attack, and sort of helped coordinate the defense for that little country. But the way he talked about broadband was, look, if there's a really big attack from a place like China, it really comes down to bandwidth. Who's got more bandwidth? Because if somebody has fatter pipes than we do and can flood our pipes, we don't have enough bandwidth left to fight back. Attacks from small countries who don't have a lot of bandwidth or small groups, we wouldn't have that much trouble defending. But it really gets down to who's got supremacy in bandwidth and how much data you can push back and forth. And clearly, you know, China is way ahead of us, and Korea perhaps. So it's an interesting perspective on it. But I'm sort of curious what you all have to say about the state of broadband in rural Minnesota, because I haven't really kept up with that much. How much better is it now than it was when I left Minnesota in 97?
Well, I can just kind of jump in just a little bit on that. And that's, I've been following Blandon on broadband. You know, they're funding education, training, and assistance with planning and so forth with outstate broadband. And there seems to be a lot of fits and starts. And there also seems to be somewhat of a wait and see attitude on the ultra high speed broadband task force that the state is driving forward on. But in fact, I did a post which on Minnovate about my relatives, who Thomas and Mary Meehan, that were in Forestville, and ultimately Forestville was bypassed by the railroad, and it went up through Preston, and Forestville as a town died. Now, it took a while, but the town just went away because it was that vital to the direction of the and the vitality of the town and jobs and everything else. And there's a great analogy between that and what's happening outstate. But there seems to be, primarily, I think, because of Blandon, a great education process that's occurred. So there's a lot of awareness in outstate Minnesota. And I think that there are, this is my opinion based on not having attended any of these ultra high speed broadband meetings, there's good representation for outstate Minnesota. And there's also a lot of voices out there having conversations at the legislative level.
Hey, Steve, did you notice how I became the interviewer all of a sudden and asked you a question? See, I'm more comfortable in the interviewer role.
Hey, go ahead. Knock
it
off.
Questions, but I don't have answers.
Well, you know, speaking of education and training, this is something that we all have talked about. I've had many conversations with clients and so on about what it would take or how it could happen to raise awareness of really what's happening with internet as a platform and social media and so on. And I'd like to ask Catherine, maybe start with you, what you think could be a catalyst to inspire leaders to learn about all of these new accelerating technologies and being involved with them and helping to drive their organizations forward with the new demand for transparency, for participation and involvement by the consuming public and other businesses that are interacting with your company. What do you think might be a good catalyst to drive that awareness forward?
For businesses to get involved in using it more, or for, you know, just kind of education?
The former.
For education to kind of get involved?
For business leaders specifically.
Oh, for business leaders.
Go
ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, you know, all the geeks in the world can adopt everything, and then the masses adopt it, and then finally the leaders recognize what's happening, and, you know, that playing that out necessarily isn't going to drive adoption.
Sure. I think that a business leaders, to really get interested and get involved in it, they sort of have to actually see a value to their business, kind of, if not in the bottom line, then at least to, you know, being a more innovative company and finding ways to, you know, improve what they're offering, their services, their products. And I honestly think a lot of that companies has to come from sort of bottom up, really listening to people who are working for them, who are really in touch with these technologies. And when they come to them and say, hey, this could really help our business, you should pay attention to this. I think that makes a huge difference.
Yep. Graham, you had a question that you pinged me on.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to hark back a little bit to the question of comparing Minnesota to other areas of tech, you know, tech centers in the country. And one thing I've heard from more than one VC is what really makes the, you know, the tech centers like the Silicon Valley and maybe Austin and Boston better for investing is the supply of management talent available to them to, you know, seed these upstart companies with the talent that will enable them to get their technologies out there and grow their companies. And I was just curious what the panel would have to say about the situation with management talent here in the Twin Cities. Now, in the Valley, obviously there have been many more successful companies that have grown and been acquired or gone public than there have here, particularly in the internet and IT space. I'm just curious what the reaction would be, particularly, I guess, with Kathy and Julio, of what they observe about the quality of management talent here. Yes, we have great developers. Yes, we have a great developer community. But do you guys really feel that maybe that is where we're, you know, shorter is in management talent?
Well, as a consumer writer at the paper, that's not the thing I focus on most of the time. But one trend I have noticed, which I'm finding very interesting, is that geography is becoming less relevant. I think the question that you're posing, you know, may have less and less relevance over time for the simple reason that technology makes geography increasingly irrelevant. Companies can be virtual. People can be working all over the place. I've run over the course of my years covering technology, I'm increasingly running into situations where a company exists and doesn't really have a headquarters because the people are spread right out all over the doggone place. You know, the CEO might be on one coast and other executives might be all over. And I think the one possible way for Minnesota to attack that problem is, you know, just to not stress out, you know, over our, you know, do we have the talent here? Because, you know, actually the talent is everywhere, and if you're creative enough about attracting people and giving them the flexibility to do their jobs regardless of where they happen to be, I think that might be the future.
Do we think it's more of a case of not having an anchor company like we have Apple and HP out west? Even in Austin, you have Texas Instruments and Dell. So that lack of having that anchor company, is that really holding us back?
I think that is something that you hear there. You know, when people, I've heard the same thing as Graham was saying from venture capitalists, that, you know, there's a shortage of them, and usually when they name some of the more talented ones, you know, you can keep them kind of on one hand. And we do have some really quality companies that some of these people could, you know, that could create a really healthy ecosystem for technology startups. I mean, it's obviously proven out to be that way in the med tech world here in Minnesota. But, you know, I've heard, you know, where are people, you know, leaving companies like Digital River? Why aren't they leaving and doing more startups? And especially in the internet space, it's kind of, that's where, you know, we have data storage is pretty good here in the Twin Cities. People leaving some companies have real experience in that area. And even some of the kind of analytics software out there now, but really interesting kind of group of companies in that area with, you know, experienced leaders. And I think in the internet space, it's even smaller here in the Twin Cities.
Yes, we don't seem to see a lot of startups. At least I don't hear of a lot of startups happening from guys that or girls that worked at Lawson Software or SoftBrands or some of the larger software companies here. And you're right, we don't hear much about people leaving Digital River and doing startups or internet broadcasting, at least not yet. But I guess I like to think that some of that may be coming. We certainly do have some great companies here, but we don't seem to have the same culture as the Valley of people wanting to get out there and do their own startups. But I guess I do see that changing. Do you, Catherine, see more of that?
I definitely agree with you. I think there's kind of an increase in energy right now, and I think that is something that definitely has the potential to change. It just kind of, you know, needs people with that adventurous spirit kind of willing to leave their company and strike out on their own. And I do, you know, hear that that's changing, and I think there's definitely a chance for that to really kind of ramp up technology here in the Twin Cities.
You wonder about the current state of the economy, though, and how that's going to affect whatever energy the Twin Cities has right now. A lot of forecasts of reduced tech spending. I just saw a note from Forrester on that. A lot of companies are sort of pulling back. I'm wondering about momentum and how that will be affected.
I was just discussing this with a startup yesterday in the storage space, and they don't feel that it's a real issue to them because storage budgets are still growing very rapidly, you know, 30% annually. And their reaction was, if that goes to half, 15%, so what? It's still a growth market. And I also think that some of the tech spending slowdown forecasts are are coming from companies that, you know, like Dell, that are already in trouble, and they're largely blaming it on the economy. But I think that, you know, the other thing I was going to say relating to slowdown in the economy is I hope that doesn't affect angel funding, which is very much a requirement for anyone thinking of going off on their own and doing a startup. That's where they're going to go first. And I would certainly hope that the angels wouldn't start, you know, pulling back on their investing activities. That to me is the biggest concern about the slowdown in the economy as relates to startups, you know, more so than the spending of their customers, perhaps at this point.
But hasn't the VC climate sort of changed, and their expectations have changed, where they're looking at more kind of funding later stage companies these days, as opposed to funding a true startup? So you either have to have, you know, a fully realized product to show them, or you really, you know, don't get funded.
I would certainly say that's the case. Yes, VCs have gone more towards later stage deals, no question about it, particularly our locally based VCs. They just aren't doing that much early stage funding, seed stage at all, really. And that's why the local angel community is so important for the startups, the internet and IT startups in this town in particular, as well as med tech.
Do you see the same thing? Oh, I'm sorry.
They are an active bunch. I mean, they are definitely making investments, but as Catherine said, much of it is going to MedTech naturally, since this state is so strong there. But we are seeing some bright, you know, examples of things, you know, light at the end of the tunnel kind of thing for internet and IT, I think is getting better here. But it's a shift from the VCs to the angels picking up the slack and filling that gap between the large fundings that VCs tend to do in the 3 to 5 million range, and the angels tend to do, you know, 100,000, 200,000. And more and more deals are being done by these angel networks that, as we all know, are coming in at, you know, $600,000-$800,000, sometimes $1 million or more, pooled from sometimes 2, 3, 4 angel networks. We're seeing more of this happening, a la Rain Source Capital.
John, are you seeing that same sort of thing?
I admit to doing some web surfing and sort of losing attention to the conversation. So I'm going to defer my answer to that question. How about that?
Graham sometimes has that effect on people. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, last time I was in Minnesota, I was on the midday program, and I did this experiment where I was trying to answer people's Twitter questions while I was – and I totally spaced out and started following – Twitter streams, and I realized Mike Mulcahy, the guest, was asking, or the host was asking questions of me, and I really had, you know, by the time he said, John, what do you think? I had no idea what the hell was going on. It happens once in a while, but I will say, has anybody heard about anything coming out of University Ventures, this new funding venture of Javed Karim from YouTube? Are they active? Have they funded anybody yet?
Not that I've
heard. Seen nothing. No. No.
Not that I know of either.
Not any of the companies I want money for. No.
But I have a question for all three of you that has been something that I met with Steve Kickert, who's the CEO of River Rock Technologies. They have a new collaboration product called OnePlace. And during the course of our conversation, we talked about the potential downtrending of the economy, or the, you know, the continued downtrending of the economy. You know, what happens if there's a risk of a terrorism attack or avian flu or businesses driving for cost reduction. And, you know, in kind of a macabre, sad way, he said, you know, I think it's going to be an accelerator for business. And I've been sort of ad hoc anecdotally asking people about that, and the answer pretty much has been, yeah, we're seeing an uptick in interest because people are looking at what we're offering as a potential replacement for something they're already doing in an attempt to drive down costs. So I'm wondering if your coverage is going to change, or the stories that you do relative to web or enterprise 2.0 or cloud computing in a time of pretty frightening and dramatic financial crisis. What do you think, Catherine?
I think that, you know, for in a time of financial crisis, there is certainly going to be some coverage of how that is going to impact the technology business. And I think it is. I think for, you know, the studies you're seeing on cutting back in spending, that's going to mostly affect, you know, IT consulting firms, you know, staffing firms, people who are performing services that companies might otherwise be able to kind of find a way to put off for another couple years. But I mean, I think there is a chance for it also to, you know, stimulate technology because people are going, companies are going to be looking for ways to cut costs. And I mean, I have talked to people in the tech services side who say that companies are still willing to spend money if it means in the long term they will be able to cut costs.
Yeah, you mentioned. Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Ken, you did mention cloud computing, and I'll throw in one trend that I've been following, which I find absolutely fascinating, which has some relevance because it does also involve cost saving for companies, which is cloud computing. Really fascinating stuff. You know, the one example that I cite because I actually use it myself is Google and it's Google Apps technology. You can map a Google account, the Gmail and all the other services to your own particular domain name, and you can do it for free if you want. And companies, small companies, even large companies, are, you know, they're essentially pitching their Exchange servers and such out the window and just, you know, going with the Google Cloud model and putting all their employee email on there and doing so quite successfully. And really fascinating. I've always been, you know, my data has to be on my computer and I have to be running desktop software, and I've been that for like that for many years. And I've slowly come around to the whole cloud aspect, and I'm a believer now because if my computer gets fried, all my data is up in the cloud, and businesses are going to increasingly go that way. Really fascinating trend, I think.
Yes, and I think more and more startups are going to be using that model. We certainly are at Duap.
How about your stories, John? Are you doing more stories on internet-centric applications, web-hosted applications, versus you know, specific technologies like Twitter and so forth?
Well, I walk kind of a fine line. I mean, my show needs to appeal to the widest number of listeners possible, so I tend to shy away from the stuff that gets too geeky and too much about the infrastructure. I mean, I have done a couple of segments about cloud computing, but it's mostly real simple stuff, just sort of explaining what it is and why you should care about it, right? I mean, I think that there's some interesting issues that I'll be covering going forward. Data security issues, is do you really want to trust the cloud with all of your important data, things like that. But I'm not real big on infrastructure stories necessarily, or stories about, you know, the real businessy stuff. I'll leave that to good reporters like Catherine and Julio more than what I do on Future Tense. I just thought of something though. You know, earlier when you asked me a question and I had no idea what you had just said, I realized I should have done the Sarah Palin thing and said, In what respect, Charlie? You know, I'm not as good as our possible future vice president at extricating myself from sticky situations, apparently.
I think that's a blessing, not a curse. Hey, listen, you know, this is Phil, and my background is media, and so I'd like to ask you a few questions. And John, you sort of alluded to it in your last observation about how comprehensive of coverage do you provide, in your various focuses, in what you do? I mean, for example, how high of a priority in the traditional media outlets that you guys are on, how priority is tech coverage? How much interest is there?
Well, Future Tense, the program that I do, has certainly been a nice little success for NPR. I mean, we've been doing it for 13 or 14 years now. And when we say we, I really mean I, because it's very much of a kind of a one-person thing. I mean, everything from being my own tech engineer and support staff to marketer to interviewer and producer and host and all that kind of stuff. But I get great response from our audiences, and I really feel like people sort of generally like to hear the coverage and are happy to have it. My role is really different from the other guests that you have right now. I mean, these two are real reporters, and I sort of view myself as more of an interviewer and an explainer than a reporter. I don't break a lot of stories. I don't go as deep into some topics as these two do. But yeah, I guess I'm like, you know, Larry King.
So your focus is more the average consumer, the average guy on the street going.
Exactly. And it's sort of, I spend a great deal of time digesting all the technology news that I can, and then sort of looking at that and going, what is going to, from this, appeal to not only the geeks and the people who really know what they're talking about in technology, but to everybody. So my job is sort of a filter and a distiller. And that's the exact focus I wanted, that I pitched like 14 years ago when we started Future Tense. And I think the formula is still working. You know, we don't do a half hour of deep technology every day or an hour on the weekend. It's 5 minutes every day where we can just say, this is what matters to you or is going to matter to you. And I think that's been a nice success.
And Julio, you positioned yourself as a consumer reporter. So, but you do you take it a little bit further and look for more cutting edge things, more breaking stories, or you were focusing the same way John does?
Well, John, I was listening to John, and John could have been describing my job, because I cater to the average consumer. I'm a filter, a distiller, and so on and so forth. But as a tech writer here, I'm always wary about sort of getting complacent. And so I'm always, not always, you know, sometimes I'll get lazy and sort of get into a rut, but, you know, I'll try, whenever possible to like look for the latest thing. And, you know, Twitter has been kind of like that for me. I'll give you one, you know, quick example. I have been working on a book about businesses that use Twitter. And interestingly, I got so excited about that project that I told my editor at one point, you know, we're a company, why aren't we on Twitter? And he thought about that for a week, and then he called me into his office and said, you know, Julio, and you have to imagine my editor, he's basically Lou Grant with hair. and he said, yeah, Julio, that Twitter thing, good idea, you do it. he had a specific idea in mind. He said, you know, we should Twitter during the Republican National Convention. So as a result, I became the voice of the Pioneer Press on Twitter during the RNC, and quite successfully. You know, people were using the number sign RNC08 hashtag. So to better keep track of RNC chatter on Twitter, and I became, you know, by far the most prolific user of that hashtag, and created a a new voice for the paper that was nationwide in scope and quite successful. So this was, I was a little apprehensive going in because, you know, this was something I had never attempted before. You know, it's one thing to write about companies using Twitter, and it's an entirely another thing to actually be a company on Twitter. But it was a thrill, and actually ended up being a new chapter in my book. So,
and ultimately you got a lucrative pay raise because of that, right?
Well, I got a nice pat on the back, and actually we're gonna keep it going. Some we're in discussions, you know, about how long term the Pioneer Press will continue to be on Twitter in some way, but we haven't figured that out yet. But you know, rest assured, the bulldog with the newspaper in its mouth on Twitter isn't going away.
When's your book coming out, Julio?
It's in the final stages of editing, so at some point, very soon, you'll see an ebook version, and then the printed version soon thereafter.
I'm in there, right?
Graham Thickens is in there. John Gordon is in there. Yep, you got a couple of people in this conversation have prominent roles in the manuscript. Indeed.
Good deal. Well, Catherine, when you are pitching the story or pitching to your editor about something that you want to cover, or is there a priority on the tech stuff, especially on the business side?
I think technology reporting is, I guess I'm a little different because we're kind of more business to business publication.
Yes.
So we're not writing for consumers. I mean, we try and explain everything in plain English, and we don't go to the level of, you know, being a trade publication, but it's a priority for our paper and for me. It's perhaps not as big of a beat as some of the others that we cover, but I, you know, regularly try and pitch stories on it. I try and stay on top of, you know, good stories about entrepreneurs here in the Twin Cities. Obviously, kind of any breaking stories related to large venture capital deals going to technology companies. And certainly trends in the industry. I have freedom to pitch whatever story I want as long as it's interesting. Usually my editor will go for it. So I would definitely say it's priority for me and for the paper.
Well, so that comes to the age-old question that you always have to ask when you're trying to build an audience or attract a readership is who cares? From your standpoint, on what you write about, and tech, let's start with you, Catherine. Who cares?
I think that, I guess maybe as part of that, I would say, how do you decide, you know, what's innovation? What should I cover? Because, there are a lot of people who have good ideas, and I'm not a business person necessarily, so I don't necessarily know if it's a great idea that's going to succeed. So a lot of times we judge that by, you know, does this company, is it being led by somebody who's done this before, who has a lot of experience? Or is it a company that does have some funding, you know, some clear, you know, evidence that somebody really believes in it enough to invest in it? And I think that when you have a company that's, you know, definitely got some promise, some real innovation, I think other businesses care about it, whether it's they're developing a product that, you know, another business might want to use. And obviously, investors care about it. I write about companies that don't have money yet that are looking for it. And, you know, they love reading about somebody that might be an opportunity for them.
Gotcha. And Julio, do you feel, I mean, when you write the piece, when you ask that question of yourself, who cares, who do you usually target? Who are you going after?
Well, I have a fairly diverse audience, and it's grown even more diverse since I've been on quite active on Twitter. So it ranges from very nerdy people, you know, who quite frankly know more than I do, and I'm often learning from them as they're learning from me. It ranges all the way to, you know, complete tech people that are completely clueless about technology. In this Sunday's paper, for instance, I have some extensive coverage about the digital television transition and, you know, people needing help with the inexpensive converter boxes they have to hook up to their analog TV so they can keep watching broadcast television. And so I have to, it's a challenge for me because I have to remain mindful that I have a very diverse audience and I need to put something out there for everybody. So, you know, this Sunday paper, I'm talking about iPhone developers, and the people who read that story will be very tech savvy, all the way down to you know, grandmothers who need guidance on the digital converters. And I have a story for them in this Sunday's paper as well.
So what determines when you're talking to your editor, and when the editor is looking at the story, what really is going to determine whether that story appears above the fold or on the third page or whatever? Is it really just sort of the relevance of the day?
To a large extent, is it a fairly prominent topic? Number one. Number two, is it very useful? Does it give people information that they value? But I'll be quite honest. I try to remain in the mindset of just writing good stories and leaving it up to my editor to sort of sell them. You know, where in the paper they're going to go. And sometimes I have a very, very good editor. Her name is Amy Nelson, and I value her judgment. And very often she'll surprise me. She'll say, hey Julio, I think this is a front page story, and I hadn't even been thinking along those lines, but it gets on the front page, not necessarily because of my efforts, but because my editor was smart, smart enough to think that the story had potential to be there.
John, what about you? When you ask that question, who cares? What's the answer, man?
Well, the answer is deeply scientific. You ready for it?
You, right?
Yeah, exactly. Do I care?
I knew it. I just knew it.
Well, it's just because, frankly, most stuff bores the crud out of me. So I'm maybe not as much of a fan of technology as some other people. So if it crosses my threshold of giving a crud, then I figure it's probably going to cross the threshold of a lot of people like me who are sort of semi-knowledgeable about technology, but not experts. So the first test is, right, do I care about this in any way? Would I want to hear this on the radio? That's usually the first test. I might apply some other things beyond that. Okay, well, I don't care that much, but I do know that, I don't care that much about Facebook stories anymore, but I know that a lot of people do. So sometimes I'll be bored with what I'm doing in some way, but I'll know that other people seem to care about that. So that's sort of what I do. And sometimes, having to be on the air every day, sometimes it's as simple as, oh my God, it's 4 o'clock and I got nothing to put on the radio. What can I get? And then it's trying to make that as interesting as possible. I mean, I think a couple of times I've run to Julio at the end of the day and said, oh, my God, you must save me because I've got nothing to put on the radio. What can you tell me? So that happens once in a while, I must admit.
And my reaction is, well, now you like me, John. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Well, I thought it was more along the lines of, have you heard about my new book? Well, let me ask another question. Media coverage or traditional media coverage of innovation and web coverage. As media outlets continue to come under attack of the fact that their audiences are shrinking, newspaper readership is down, radio listenership is down, that sort of thing. Obviously, that amount of listenership and readership is vital to the media outlet as a revenue source. They've got to have a big audience to sell, the right amount of advertising to make the money. Are you finding there's always been that sort of firewall between, the advertising and the editorial? Are you finding that because of more difficult financial times, not only for media, but for everybody, difficult financial times, are there more compromises being made as far as, how content might reflect the revenue side or the advertising side? And I can start with, Julio, if you've seen anything like that.
Compromise. I'm not sure if all compromises in terms of what?
You know, is an article that you may be you may write about going to be more predicated on? Listen, these guys are doing a big spend with us on an advertising campaign. Could you possibly write an article about their technology? We always got those requests from the advertising department and didn't always have to deal with that. Is it becoming more of a need? Do you have to deal with that?
I'm very happy and delighted actually to say that in my 20 years at the Pioneer Press, I've never once run into anything remotely like that, and I hope I never do, because that would be the end if my coverage were predicated on a dollar value that would be coming into the paper. So yeah, thankfully the answer is a firm no on that.
Catherine, have you experienced that at all?
No, actually, I would agree that I haven't. It's sort of that, I think the traditional, at least papers I've worked at, separation of kind of church and state there has remained intact, which is a good thing.
Are you aware of that happening in the print industry at all? Do you is there, you're sitting around the room and talking to other writers and saying, hey, did you hear about? I mean, is that happening in the industry?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I haven't heard that much complaint about it. There has been some sort of, you know, debates about, for instance, putting ads on the front page.
Yeah.
So, you know, should you do that? So I've seen more concerns over sort of concepts like that rather than actual tension between editorial and advertising, you know, bickering about what kind of story should go where or mm-hmm. because of what ad.
Okay. And Julio, you were going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say those are the kinds of things that don't necessarily bother me. You know, if you're going to put an ad on the front page, I don't have a problem with that. That happens a lot in newspapers in other countries, in South America, for instance. Very, you know, very very common. And I do think, you know, newspapers, you know, need to be flexible. They need to try new things with advertising. Even, you know, even if it's like really annoying, like sometimes there are some banner ad experiments going on newspaper websites, and I find them intrusive and kind of annoying. But I kind of live with them because, you know, this is sort of the price you need to pay, you know, to get some money coming in. And I think there are a lot of people that are mentally inflexible, and they resist, you know, new ideas. And I don't have a problem with them as long as, you know, they don't impose conditions, you know, on what I can and can't write. So,
John, do you find it at all? You know, look, you and I share the radio background together. So, you know, do you find in your situation being a more of a feature editor, a feature producer, does that happen to you at all, or are you asked to move on anything like that?
No, that doesn't really happen. There's probably been suggestions of stories a few times from people over the years, but they never seemed, you know, tied to any kind of coverage or partnerships. I mean, there's certainly never been even a whiff of news payola or anything in my 20-year career in public radio. So I'm real happy to say that situation continues. I don't think, you know, I think just as far as economic pressures, certainly the print business is struggling more than in public radio right now. But I get the sense that possibly 5-6 years down the road, you know, public radio could look a little worse than it does now and more like newspapers than they do now. I hope not. We're trying really hard to make sure we reach audiences in different ways and be more proactive with digital media. And I think NPR is doing a pretty dang good job in that. So I'm, you know, we're all working really hard to try to prevent deep pain in our business model as more folks get their news and information online rather than in traditional ways.
And I wanna pay NPR a couple of compliments before I forget. Number one, I'm Don Gordon's biggest fan. I just love what he does, and I'll keep repeating that till I die. And the other thing I'm really kind of excited about, and this sort of falls in line with what John is saying about, you know, finding new audience and trying new things, is NPR recently did something which I, as an iPod user, I'm very, very excited about. They worked with a local iPhone software developer to create a streaming audio application that you can load on an iPhone or an iPod Touch and listen to the current or classical music or KNOW. That way, you can already stream the stuff on a computer, but now you can do it on a handheld device over a Wi-Fi or 3G connection. And as somebody that isn't a big radio listener in the traditional sense, but does value a great deal of radio content, this is just huge for me. I can put my earbuds in my ear and push a button on my touch screen and be listening to John's show or whatever. And so I'm very excited about that. And I compliment NPR, you know, for thinking outside the box and doing something like that.
Is it working pretty well? I haven't gotten to test the app yet.
It's working great. And it's very elegantly. I have a blog post on it at yourtechweblog.com today. It's working great. It looks great. It works great. Sounds great. It's a win. It's definitely a win. So kudos for that.
I'll put that in the show notes, so everybody can find that, because that's how I found out about it, was from your post.
I had a Twitter tweet recently where I described public radio as more addictive than crack.
Well, to respect all of your time, and again, we so appreciate you guys carving out an hour on a Saturday morning of all things. Let's end with this, and I'll start with you, Catherine, and then Julio and John. What's the one internet web trend that really excites you? And what out of that might be a tip for innovators and startups in Minnesota to direct some attention to?
One internet trend. I would actually say the one internet trend that excites me the most is access to online video and even, you know, being able to watch HDTV quality, you know, movies and things along those lines online, I think is just amazing. And I always like reading and learning about technology that's kind of supporting that right now.
What's your favorite site for, do you watch TV shows on the web?
I do. I admit I probably actually watch them most on whatever TV station is broadcasting them's website, which is, I know exactly what they want me to do. But so yeah, I would say mostly that.
Yep. How about you, Julio?
Yeah, I'll echo that and expand on it. I've become a big fan of doing anything that does not require me to put the, like, download a file or install a program on my computer. So if I like to watch TV, you know, on sites like Hulu, which in some cases are high definition. I like to edit my photos using web-based photo editors. I've already talked about cloud computing, you know, getting your files, your email. I've become a big believer on getting myself into a situation, you know, where if lightning strikes my home and it burns down, I can grab somebody else's computer and just continue doing what I was doing, because all my information is off the machine. So the whole cloud computing trend, which includes video, includes photo editing, includes email, includes anything, you know, just your whole digital life is in that browser. That is something I'm very excited about. You know, Google recently came out with its Chrome browser, which is sort of a stripped down browser, which is all about that. It's all about web apps. You know, your applications are up in the cloud, and that's where your life is.
How about you, John?
In what respect, Charlie? I know what you were saying. I am excited about absolutely nothing right now, because I'm in the grumpiest possible mood about technology. In the last month, I've had my MacBook Pro in for repair twice. It's probably has $1,500 worth of repairs in it right now. Thank goodness it was under warranty. I've had my iMac in for repair, and it has broken again. My digital audio editing equipment has been on the fritz. My Airport Express and Time Capsule have not been working well. The tower for my cell phone, which is behind my house, went out, and I haven't had cell phone access for long. I mean, I'm honestly, God, everything I own has been screwed up, and so I'm in no mood to say anything positive about anything. How's that?
Here's what you do. Here's what you do. You light a candle and you read a book and just do your Abe Lincoln for the next couple of days.
It sounds extremely appealing. I think I will.
Oh, man. What a tale of woe. Well, on that incredibly bright ending, I would like to thank each one of you again. Really appreciate it. And look for the post in the next couple of hours up on Minovate. And we'll talk to you hopefully again soon.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
Thank you, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.